so we started talking, we continued talking last week, yesterday rather, about the Isser of Shihui without Ksuba. What does that mean to have a prohibition to be married without a Ksuba? And we saw that there are different views really in the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah and in the later Svarim. Is it basically an Isser to be married at all? Whether you call that Yichud, the Shulchan Aruch answers. We mentioned that more recently, the Tshuvas Dvar Yehoshua wrote that to enter into Kishrei Yishus at all without a Ksuba is a problem, or is the issue really Bia? And that's the way the Ramah understood, or the Sabah Rav was quoted by the Dvar Yehoshua. And then how Yichud fits in, and we discussed yesterday, could depend. Is Yichud independently a problem because it means living with her without a Ksuba? Or Yichud, because you don't want to come to Bia, and Bia is a problem, according to everyone, without Iksuba. So this is an ongoing debate, a little bit, and it has many practical implications. You know, one practical implication, of course, is if a couple finds themselves without Iksuba, so what is prohibited to them? Are they prohibited only in Bia? Are they prohibited in Yichud as well? We mentioned yesterday, even though normally a husband and wife often have times when they're prohibited in Bia, such as Nida and Yom Kippur is coming up and the like, and we don't prohibit Yichud for them. So that'll revolve around the question, is Yichud independently a problem? But that question aside, so what else happens to a husband and wife who find themselves without Ksuba? So after already entering into marriage, so they had Ksuba at one point and now they don't. So what exactly is prohibited to them? And what can you do about it? So the easiest thing, or the most complete thing, rather, you can do is to write a new ksuba. Right? That there are texts. Nowadays, you can find a text online. It's not so hard. So that's certainly a straightforward way to address it. But it could be there are easier ways to address it also, or at least ways that effective in the interim, if it's too hard to write a new ksuba, so there are, at least to write one quickly, and we're worried about what is it that's usur? Is it bia's usur? Is it living together at all that's usur? Is it being married that's usur? Which clearly would be a problem. So there are those who suggest that there are various eitzahs. One eitzah is to give your wife a mashkon. If you give her something of value, which she'll be able to have so that she can claim that as a benefit for the ksuba, so then maybe that will be just as effective. She'll have essentially the protection by being able to hold on to the mashka. This comes up also, by the way, what happens if a situation arises on Shabbos? So let's say you have a realization on Shabbos that there's no ksuba anymore. So what can be done then when you can't write a ksuba? So that might be one possible suggestion. Shmuley?
Yeah, because you have said not really holding so much in the field of custom and what belongs to the wife, what she actually is the owner of, but if you give her a mashkon, is that really her mashkon? Is there such a thing as being a marriage?
Yeah, because here, it's a good question what she owns and what he owns and what they own together. There are differences. There is theoretically space for her to own her own things. But here, the emphasis about a mashkon, because we find mashkon also in other contexts, it's a good question what it means. In the sugya in the Gemara, balchov kona mashkon, and we give, let's say, you borrow money from somebody, right? So, and you give them a mashkon, because you borrowed the money. So is the point that they take ownership of the mashkon specifically? So maybe they do, maybe they don't, but either way, that's not necessarily why you're doing it. Right? You're doing it so that they will have physical possession of the mashkon, so that if you don't pay up, they can hold on to it. So too, here, the point is not so much whether she owns this mashkon. Maybe she does, maybe she doesn't, but it's protection for her one way or another, because bottom line, if she doesn't get her money, she'll physically hold on to it, and the husband won't have it. And she can sell it, you know, if she wants, if that's the way it turns out. So whether she owns it in the interim, it's less important to us, you know, what exactly is the status of ownership. The physical possession that can protect her against default, that's really what we're interested in. Hi.
Why is it less important to us than there being nachmin if she does take ownership of it, if you're allowed to do it on Shabbos?
to me saying if that becomes a Kenyan itself.
Right.
Yeah, it's an interesting question whether or not that would be an Isser Kenyan. There are ways around that. Right, there are ways to address that. But you're right, it's an interesting side kind of question that would come up if you're saying giving the mashkon is itself a Kenyan. Except that here, presumably also not, because part of what we'll see plays a role here is that the hischaifus here happened before, and the mashkon, in the words of the Yonas Elman was a sefer that was written by a Talmud Chacham who died young, and he's quoted by Rebbaruch Ber, the Berakhos Shmuel, in one place with a line that became a well-known line in his name. It's quoted in Yiddish, in the mashkon leint achov, that the mashkon is the physical representation of the debt. So the debt is there from before, and this is the physical symbol of it. So really, even with general kinyanim being a problem, here this is really different. This represents a pre-existing transaction, a pre-existing chov. So what we're really interested in is that this is a protection for her to be able to hold on to it if she doesn't get what she wants, and the kinyan is less interesting to us. As Rav Asher Weiss points out, this won't help us for Shabbos, but the simplest thing to do during the week, if you don't have the ability to write an iksula, is to give her a check. Because that way you can make the check the exact amount, you don't have to search around for a mashkon in the house that happens to correspond, and you know that it will be worth what it's supposed to be worth, and whatever that is, that itself is a whole discussion, but if we, Luyat Seer, we knew exactly what the number was, you could make the check out for exactly that, and that's the simplest and easiest way to do it. So that's probably a solid suggestion. I don't know if there's another hand up first. Hi.
You said that each phrase is written in Shiva, that's
why Shiva there. Yeah, right, so there is a text for that. And, you know,
specifically for a lot, like Shiva
right. Right, so that's, you know, that's the most straightforward way to do it. But let's say it's Shabbos, so let's say you don't know how to do that, let's say you don't have access to that, let's say you can't get the rabbi on the phone so quickly to figure out how to do it. So as far as an interim method, so these are especially if you believe that the Isser is yichud or being married at all, so then you know you kind of need to deal with it very quickly. So these options might be quicker than writing out a new ksuba.
Hi. I don't know if we discussed yesterday about the fact that they already had a ketubah,
mm-hmm.
and the simple fact is that it's not there anymore. Why does it matter to make another one?
So it does help. So there are poskim who also point out that even if worst case scenario, let's say you don't have a ketubah and you don't have a mashkon, you don't have a check, you don't have anything. So there are at least two other points which help. So one is that what happens at the chuppah itself, what happens at the wedding itself, so you guys were asking about this the other day, so it's interesting, you know, people who don't look very closely and who haven't been married yet aren't really aware of how exactly it happens, that in Ashkenazi circles, so the chassan doesn't sign the ksuba himself for the most part. The common Ashkenazi practice is that the ksuba is not signed by the chassan. The Sfardim, they do have a place in the ksuba for the chassan to sign. And you might think that the Sephardi position here is more intuitive, right? The whole point is this is an obligation from the husband to the wife, so why shouldn't he sign it? Isn't that the whole point? The whole point is he's acknowledging the schov. So you have a good point there. But how do we do it without that? Is that the Eidim are signing on the ksuba. So what are they signing? They're signing a piece of paper. How do you know the piece of paper means anything? They could have written it themselves. So the point is they are acknowledging that they witnessed the kinyan of the hischaivus, that the husband, or the chassan, before the wedding, we usually do this at the tish. That's when this usually takes place. It could happen different times also. But this usually takes place at the chassan's tish. So the chassan lifts up a pen or a handkerchief or whatever it is, and they watch when that happens. So when they sign the ksuba, they are establishing that they saw this kinyan take place. So one could make a case, as some do, that at the end of the day, that represents this chov. Now, it's going to be hard for her to prove it without the ksuba, so you can see why it's not so 100%. You'd think that she would need to be able to come to Beis Din with something to be able to establish this as the case. But the fact that there was a hischaivus in front of Eidim, and theoretically, if she remembers who the Eidim are, she could call them up and say, come to Beis Din on my behalf. So that does provide her with some degree of protection, which I think is what you're getting at, and that's better than nothing. That is something that's valuable on some level. So as you're basically saying, that shouldn't be distinguished between a married couple that has had a ksuba and a couple that has not yet had a ksuba. You're right, that is one reason to distinguish pretty significantly. So it was up first.
I mean, can I just follow up?
Yes.
Sorry. So if the Gemara...
close to the first Tosefta's ksuba.
Yeah. If the language of the Gemara is that tefillos is not, it sounds like, because we don't know if you're getting into this relationship with the commitment. But once you're already in the relationship and you've already shown the commitment, it sounds like it shouldn't be a problem.
Maybe, but maybe not, because you could equally say that the commitment could slip away. That for him to initially come in with all these obligations, but if the obligations are no longer there, let's say theoretically he's decided to, I'm taking up your ksuba and ripping it up, so you could say that, all right, so when it started, she wasn't treated like a kadesha, but now she is being treated like a kadesha. So it's not necessarily the case that just because that was there at one point, it's going to always be like that. You know, you could theoretically erode that. You wrote it 100%, not necessarily, but it could be that you wrote it enough that Chazal are not happy with this. Adam?
You're sitting on that check or whatever, the solution of Russia Weiss, you wrote it that it has to be adjusted for inflation.
So then you have to figure out what exactly
because
is the...
Because, I mean, the text of the ksuba doesn't list it in dollar amount.
Right, so then that's a whole separate discussion. We can talk about how you analyze what the number is. But whatever the number is, we could talk about that. You know, that's itself an interesting discussion, but let's assume for now that we know the number. Figuring out the first number to begin with is itself a whole story. We'll have to find the right opportunity to talk about that. But let's stipulate for now that you know the number, so you can write that number on a check. To be safe, you can write more, because you have a Tosefta ksuba, then you for sure cover it. Right? But if you have a big enough check, that should accomplish it. So one question, like we said, is figuring out what exactly is usur. That ksuba is important because you could have a married couple find themselves at ksuba and need to know what to do. But it's also important to know for a couple getting married, so by which stage do they need to have the ksuba? At what point is the ksuba crucial? So this comes up, by the way, all the time. This time of year, really any time of year. So a very, very common halachic shaila comes up constantly is... what happens if the wedding is taking place, the chuppah is taking place around Bein Hashmashos time, around Shkia time, right? This comes up constantly. Because the question is, when that's the case, you know, nowadays, let's say you're having a chuppah sometime between 7 and 8, right? It's a very conceivable scenario. So what date goes on the ksuba? It's a big halachic discussion that comes up all the time. So, on the one hand, you could say, well, what's a safe approach? I mean, if we don't know, if the wedding is 7 o'clock tonight, right? So we don't know, should we put Wednesday's date or Thursday's date on the ksuba?
Good.
So what are the pros and cons of both?
You can't have like a start date earlier than
that. So that seems to be a big issue, right? That if you put Wednesday's date, so what many are afraid of is that if the wedding doesn't actually take place until halachic Thursday, until after Shkia, so then we have is a predated shtar. And the Gemara in the first Daf Rosh Hashanah and a few other places tells us that shitrechov hamakdamin sulim, that if you have documents that are predated, they're puzzle. You can post-date a shtar. That doesn't bring about so many problems, but a predated shtar is puzzle. Why is that? Because when you have a shtar, if a shtar represents a debt, so let's say you have land that is supposed to back up the shtar, and you sell the land to somebody else. So if you sell the land from before you made this commitment, so then that's the other guy's land. But if you sold it after you made the commitment, maybe that land should have been under a lien for the ksuba. So we need to know when was the shtar done. So if you make the shtar early than it actually was, we're worried how that's going to interfere with land that you've transferred to somebody else in between. So a shtar that's predated is very problematic. That's completely possible. Shtar that's post-dated, okay, we're not so worried about that, it doesn't have the same problems. So that theoretically, on one hand, is less of a problem. So that's one opening issue. A few other issues, though. So who do we have first? We had Ben and Michael.
Just a technical question. This is for the date of when the So it was actually being handed over. That's the time frame we're talking about.
So that's what we're trying to figure out. Well, we're trying to figure out what's important, basically. That's the question.
No, just to take a meaning, like, a time is when the Kiddushin takes place, so when the Nisuin has handed over.
Well, we're worried about when the Nisuin is taking place. Okay. Right? So the question is, when, if we're going to have things happening at some ambiguous time, right? Let's assume the Chuppah might be Nisuin, the Yichud might be Nisuin. So we have this kind of continuum of things happening, and we can't so clearly pin down what date it is because it's happening around Bein HaShemashos time. So what is important for the Ksuba to represent? So on the one hand, you could say, well, we're worried maybe it's safer to use the later date because an early Shtar is going to be possible. Sorry, did I cut off your question?
Yeah, this is more of a business ethic question. Are you allowed to create checks to give to people?
So post-date, the pre-date is the problem. See, post-date is common practice. That the idea of post-date is that, you know, I'm giving you a check so you have it now, but you can't use it too early. So that, you know, schools do that all the time because they want the security of having the check, but they're agreeing that they're not going to take it before you have it. Let's say you're worried you're not going to have money in the bank. So that's a pretty accepted practice, that I'm giving you this money for the future and you can't access it now, but you have essentially a guarantee that you'll be able to access it at some date in the future, the date that's actually on the check. Predating, I'm not sure what that accomplishes in a positive sense. But post-dating is common practice. I don't think it necessarily involves any issues, unless you do it, you know, you kind of slip it past the other guy without him knowing, so then you're depriving him of his money. Let's say if I'm buying something and I give you a check and I post-date it and you don't see that I post-date it because you don't pay attention, so now you can't collect it for another few months or whatever it is, and then you're deprived of your money for those months and you didn't agree, that's an ethical problem. But if we make an arrangement knowingly that I'm going to give you a check and you know you won't be able to cash it for a few months, but then when the date kicks in you will, that should be theoretically okay. So just to finish off this first point, sorry. So it seems like from that perspective, if the ksuba is post-dated, so that's the safer approach. So is that a slam dunk? Is there no way to make the earlier date work? So you do have poskim who say that the earlier date is also viable because the kinyan that we just referred to a few minutes ago, we said the eidim witnessed the kinyan hischaivus at the tish, so since that happened already, the earlier date, so if you had a wedding tonight, let's say, so if the chuppah was at 7, so it means that the tish is going to be at 6, so the hischaivus is going to happen then, so you can say, all right, that's enough. The fact that he hasn't actually brought her into the chuppah yet, there hasn't actually been the suin, but it's okay, the shtar represents the time from which he incurred the obligation, that's not called a predated shtar. So that would be the counter-argument to that issue. On the other hand, starts to finish this point, I'll take a question in a second. So what the advantages or the disadvantages of using the later date? So then it becomes a question. So what exactly is the risk of using the later date? Right, so let's say, all right, I want to avoid a predated shtar, that'll be possible. So then let me date Thursday tonight so I won't have to take on that risk. So then it becomes a question, well, at what point are you chayiv to have a ksuba? At what point does it become an isser of being married without the ksuba? So if you want to focus, for example, on yichud, which seems to be a pretty popular point to focus, so then you could say, all right, so maybe the chuppah is going on between 7 and 8, but, you know, the Sheva Brachas and the speech and there's the Meshkechech and all that stuff, so it's hard to imagine that it's such a long Bein HaShemashos period that by the time they're finally danced to the yichud room, that it's still already going to be without the wrong date. It's still going to be the wrong date. So chances are, if we're talking about a chuppah happening in Bein HaShemashos, so that the Bein HaShemashos is not so long, by the time they actually get to the yichud, that's the very end of this whole ceremony, so then it's probably a safe guess that the date has become correct if you take a later date, and therefore at least we'll have yichud with ksuba. You don't have to worry that there'll be yichud without ksuba. So those are broad strokes, the pluses and minuses of going for the earlier date to the later date. But this is one of the nafkaminas, the question of what exactly is the isser of being married without a ksuba. What is it that you're not allowed to do without a ksuba? Parenthetically, in terms of yichud, there are some who say that maybe even yichud at this point without the ksuba could theoretically be defensible also, because we could say we don't have to worry about the znus that the Gemara talks about at that point. Yichud normally is a concern that there'll be a physical relationship. So you could tell the woman that it's not in her interest. That the whole point is that Ksuba is supposed to protect her, and if she gets involved in a physical relationship without a Ksuba, so that's going to be against her protection, it's going to be against her interest. There are some who say that that may also be helpful as far as even allowing Yichud before the Ksuba date sets in. Sorry to interrupt.
Would that even apply in any case where the wedding was supposed to happen on Wednesday?
So, which part applies? So, to use the.
Would it apply that some folks would say that the earlier date would work?
Well, so if you don't have the kinyan then, if the Masada condition didn't start anything before Shkia, so then it would be a little bit complicated. You wouldn't really have so much to point to. But in most cases, let's say, where we have this question, right. See, if there's only a, this question really only comes up when it's a relatively narrow window, right? Because if it's a morning chuppah, the chuppah is 11 o'clock in the morning, so you're not going to worry about confusion of dates. So you'd have to be really late in order for that to be a problem. So when we talk about the hischayus happening at the beginning at the tish and the yichud happening at the end, so it's less likely that those two markers will happen at ambiguous times.
That's what happened to my parents, actually.
That they both happened at ambiguous times?
The Masada Kiddush was late and ended up getting pushed.
And even the Kenyan was...
Their Masada Kiddush went out of New Zealand.
Because he had used the earlier day.
Yeah.
Right, so it could be that they didn't have anything to rely on at that point, that it was the earlier day, because they didn't have the Kenyan. Or maybe the original plan was that everything was going to take place in the earlier day. And the later date. Yeah, that's one of the many. That's one of the many risks of the big fancy
Ksuba.
Yeah,
that's a very common
scenario. Yeah, it happens more often than you think. Yes. Sorry.
It's probably obvious, but why can't one make a ketubah to a woman before he does kedushin at all? If we get divorced in the future, which I plan on marrying first. Not doing a divorce, but if we get divorced, then I would go to such
and such. And take the Hischaivus from that point.
Take on the Hischaivus way before Shkia, and then it doesn't matter when they do the.
Yeah, Pashas, you can. So that's what those poskim were relying on, assuming that actually happens. So the average person is not going to do that stam because if he doesn't know that the marriage is going to happen, so he doesn't want to take on the Chiyuv. The average person is only going to take on the Chiyuv pretty close to the wedding itself.
Yeah, it's because, wedding.
Right, so you could do it. That's essentially exactly what happens, right? That relatively early on in the evening, relatively early on in the wedding event, this kind of just happens. Now it's also the practice, so we have compressed Erison and Nisuin into one event, but there's also the Tanoim, right? So the question of what the Tanoim is, not everyone has Tanoim at their wedding, but the Tanoim is really kind of a holdover from an old practice. They used to have a separate gathering, not so long ago, less than 100 years ago, they were doing this in America too. It's not it's not as ancient as the Kedushin several months before. But the Tanoim would be a event where the two families would sit together and they would write out a shtar representing a commitment to each other. They're going to go through with it. And that doesn't require a get. It doesn't have that type of power of an actual marriage, but it does have monetary bite to it, so that if the shidduch is broken off at that point, so then there could be a big monetary obligation from one side to the other. So nowadays, this is not so commonly done in advance of the wedding. Again, it was done not so long ago. There are people alive who can tell you about being involved in these ceremonies. But nowadays, what often happens, it's more often than not happens, is we still have the Tanoim, but they happen at the wedding itself. So it's a little bit funny because you say, okay, I commit, I'm going to go through with it 5 minutes from now, literally. So why do we still do it? So as Rabbi Willig explains, you do it for
kibbutz.
Three more kibbutzim. Exactly, right. So if you want to have more people who you can include in the wedding ceremonies, you have two eidim and somebody to read it. So it's a little bit more to do at the tish, and then the mothers come in and break the plates, the whole story. So it gives you more things to happen at the wedding, but strictly speaking, it's hard to understand a little bit why we do it. So,
Happiest reason.
Sorry?
Happiest reason. Tradition.
Yes, tradition, again, more kibbutzim. And, you know, but it also just reflects the fact, the question you're asking. So, theoretically, you could take on a commitment a long time before the wedding, and we have different historical versions of that, whether it's having the kiddushin a year before the wedding, whether it's having tanoim sometime before the wedding, or whether it's having the hischaivus for the ksuba 45 minutes before the wedding. We have different degrees of how this happens. But theoretically, yeah, that's possible to become obligated in one way or another. Some ways require a get, some ways will carry a big financial penalty, some ways will just carry the ksuba itself. But yes, in theory, you're becoming obligated sometime before the wedding. Okay, did I have another hand up? Sorry? The plate, Ray wants to get to break the plate, right? Yeah, the very end of the plates. Yeah, so that's also a part of it.
You make artwork out of it.
That's, some people do that. That's right. So three more kibbutzim, more artwork, more zech l'chorban, more singing, mazel tovs. Yeah, so these are all pluses. So again, this all kind of goes to the question of what exactly is the importance of the ksuba? Where is the ksuba important? Now, if you look at the Rambam's language, so the Rambam seems to require the ksuba before you go to the chuppah, and that without it, right, what was his language? Without it, you're looking at a possible biasnus. So the question is, what exactly does he mean by that? So one of the things to be aware of, and to maybe contrast it with, is the Rambam's position about chuppas nida. The Rambam has a big chumra about this, the other Rishonim didn't accept, and we don't really accept this halacha l'maisa, but it's important to understand the contrast. So the question is, what exactly is the issue with chuppas nida, right? So we know that ideally the wedding will be scheduled in such a way that the kala is not a nida on the night of the wedding. Now, if she is, so what are the consequences and what are the strategies? So l'maisa, it does happen, right? Nothing's perfect, so it certainly can happen that the kala will be nida on the wedding night. So it's not the end of the world. What happens? It's a little awkward because essentially there are halachos, right? There are certain prohibitions that a husband and wife are not allowed to have intimate type of gestures and other types of interactions, which are actually more than your average unmarried man and woman, or even a woman married to somebody else, and a man married to somebody else. So they have prohibitions of Nigiyah and Yichud and the like, but the prohibitions between a husband and wife for a Nida are even more severe than that. So that would apply at that point. And it would seem to include an Isser Yichud, because even though, as we said yesterday, a husband and wife are allowed to be alone together when the wife is a Nida, but that's only true if they've already been together before. Then we assume, okay, so this being alone together doesn't represent such an opportunity that they can't pass up on. But if they've never been together before, i.e. they're just getting married, so then we are worried about the Yetzer Hara being a powerful force, and then there is an Isser Yichud for the Chasan and Kala. So that clearly becomes very difficult, because to get married and not to be able to be alone together is awkward and could take a little while for it to clear up. So they have to have other people living with them for a little while, and they can't go to the yichud room with nobody there. You know, there are many fascinating stories of the one person who knows about what's going on hiding in the yichud room so nobody else knows that he's there. There are many fascinating stories about this. So essentially,
comes up in rooms. Talmud hides under the bed.
Right, but here the Chasan and Kala want him there, and they know he's there, but the rest of the people shouldn't know he's there. So there are a number of discrete ways to deal with it, but clearly it's awkward and has all kinds of complexity to it, and it's not what anybody wants. So we try to avoid that. But l'maisa, if there is a chuppas nida, so you deal with it, and they're still married. and it doesn't undo the wedding, unless you're the Rambam. The Rambam feels that the chuppas nida is a fundamental problem, because the Rambam writes that chuppas nida is an issue of yichud haroi ubiya, that the whole point of yichud, the yichud that's supposed to create this kesher of marriage, has to be a yichud in which bia is a possibility. And as he understands it, that if there is a halachic impediment to bia, that there is a nida problem, so then that gets in the way of the chuppah taking place. So the chuppah being effective, rather. So that's the big chumrah of the Rambam, that not only is a chuppah's nida a awkward, uncomfortable situation with halachic complexity, but it's more than that, according to the Rambam. It actually means that the wedding is not chal at that point. Then you'll have all kinds of questions how to deal with it. Now, halacha maisa, that's not our problem, because we don't follow the Rambam's position on this, so we just have the awkwardness, but it's an important position. Michael?
The Rambam believes that the chuppah is some sort of yichud, right? Is that the time in which it has to be clear, or is it another separate yichud in which this is the issue?
Yeah, it's really another separate yichud, because the Rambam calls chuppah and yichud the same thing. What he really means is using chuppah as the word for nesuin. So yichud is chuppah, i.e. nesuin. So he really means the yichud when they're alone. And that, he says, if that was a yichud that was Zainu Roy Lubia, so then that would be a problem. That would be a fundamental issue in the marriage. So that leaves you room, just to his point, that leaves you room to question, okay, so if he says that, so then what does he mean about chuppah without exuba? Right, you could say that a chuppah without a ksuba, which he calls like a vilas nus, it's the same thing. That maybe that's also, and you say there's an ister yichud without ksuba, so it's not roi lubia. You're not allowed to be with your wife physically without a ksuba. So then maybe the same story. Chuppah nida is not kona according to the Rambam. So a chuppah without a ksuba is also not kona according to the Rambam. Right, one could have come to that conclusion. There's enough elements there to come to that position. However, if you saw, I think I put this on the Maamar Kamos, the Beis Shmuel. Did I put that on the Maamar Kamos? So the Beis Shmuel, okay, take a look at the Beis Shmuel in Evan Ezer and Samach Aleph in Sif Gimel. So we've gotten Gimel. So the Beis Shmuel writes in the Rambam, but he doesn't think the Rambam means it to the same degree. It's not the same thing as a Chuppah's Nida. The Kedushin would be Chal, the Nesuman would be Chal. It's just there would be an Isser, that it would be such a violation of what Chazal wanted, that essentially that would be karuv le'bilas nos. So that the Rambam grouping these things essentially together doesn't mean to say that it would have the same consequence. One maybe could have come to this conclusion. There's enough there to bring you that far. But essentially that doesn't seem to be the case. It's wrong. It would be a violation of the Tikkunis Chazal, and it would grant a negative status on the wedding itself and the togetherness itself, but it wouldn't necessarily passel the condition. Hi. Passel Nisun, I mean to say, yeah.
Hypothetically, if you had a husband who refused to give his wife a get, and you knew that the marriage was chuppah's nida, would relying on the Rambam
it would be a very difficult problem is that you would have Kedusha, though. So a Kedusha already needs to get. So it would be hard to work off that premise. Yeah. Difficult. Hi.
So the Kedusha Nisun would work, but it would be some kind of Esther according to the...
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. Essentially, that the Rambam is going to insist that you have this beforehand, and this insistence doesn't mean that it wouldn't work otherwise. If it would work, it would be wrong.
Isn't it a mitzvah of there?
That's an interesting question itself. You know, no one really says that here, but it's an interesting question to explore what exactly mitzvah habavi avera means in general. So normally we talk about mitzvah habavi avera just very parenthetically, because these are whole other sugyas. So mitzvah habavi avera normally is a question if a mitzvah can be fulfilled when you have an avera at the same time. So if that applied here, it would mean maybe that you don't get a mitzvah for it, but it wouldn't mean that the Kedushin is not chal. it's an interesting discussion also about whether you say mitzvah above the aveira when the aveira is drabbanon, which essentially is what it would be if you're talking about the tzuba being the issue.
Unless he, Shmuel is saying that the Rambam would consider that a kedusha situation.
But even, you know, but even the actual ksuba, that's what we discussed in the Rambam and Sefer Mitzvah, he uses ksuba, and the assumption that many have, he doesn't mean the shtar ksuba, he means shtar ksuba, it means other things. So it seems pretty clear here, he's talking about that we insist on you having the whole package drabanan. So we're to create a mitzvah of avi without it is an interesting question, but either way, all that would probably mean is you wouldn't get shtar mitzvah, it wouldn't undo the question, it wouldn't undo the chalos. There is a different concept, which probably also doesn't come to play here, but it's closer, that the Gemara says in Torah that you have an Indian that kol man da amar rachmana lo zayvin iyavi bo mahani, that anything the Torah says you shouldn't do as an iser, so if you do it, the chalos doesn't take place. So would this enter into this category? Probably not either, but it's a little bit closer than mitzvah b'av yaver. Kiva?
With the marriage, you saw a week later,
that's what it seems like, but then the question is also, if you need Eidim, a couple questions come into play. You know, do you need Eidim for Nisuin at all? Do we assume there is essentially Eidus when the couple lives together and everyone knows that? Is that considered to be Eidus? You get to some complicated questions about that. Again, it's not our practical problem because we don't assume this position, but it's a little bit of a complicated question. Okay, so that also all becomes important in terms of figuring out what exactly is going on. So we mentioned before, I think I only mentioned one of them, I said that there are at least two factors to maybe be more makel nowadays if you don't have the ksuba. So one that's also very frequently mentioned is the Rama. The Rama in Sif Gimel over there. The Rama writes that nowadays there is another reason could be a little bit more makel on the absence of the ksuba. What is that? That reason is that if we assume that we want to have a ksuba kidei shelo yehei kala beinav lehotzia, that he shouldn't too casually be ready to divorce her. So says the Rama, nowadays in our lands we have cherem derabbeinu gershom. Right, so cherem derabbeinu gershom will prevent a woman from being divorced against her will. So one could make the case that the ksuba is less important nowadays, or at least in the sense of requiring a ksuba to be there constantly at every minute of the marriage, to say there's an iser to exist in marriage without the ksuba, so one could make the case that the ksuba is a little bit less important. So the Rama himself writes that, this is on our comments, right? This is all. So the Rama writes that still, the minig is to have it, so he doesn't rely on this in a full-on kind of way. But you do find later poskim at least including it. When you have an emergency situation, whatever it is, the fact that maybe we're a little bit less concerned about the ksuba nowadays because of what the Rama quotes is something that comes into the conversation. Now, that's also interesting because that goes to the question that we asked yesterday, and that what exactly is this idea of ksuba and shlo yehei kala beinav lehotzia? Is it just a safeguard to keep him from divorcing her? Or is it more than that? Is it a completion of the whole obligation of marriage, a kind of a fleshing out of the picture of marriage? So this Rama, at least this possibility within the Rama, is really focusing only on the divorce prevention fact. That as long as we can say that the reason that divorce is not too likely, then the ksuba becomes less important. One could have said differently, right? One could have said that it's not just about keeping him from divorcing her. It's about creating a larger package of obligations between the two, and that itself is important. And indeed, like we said, the Rama himself doesn't really think this should be the approach. It doesn't mean it is not that way. But to whatever extent you think that this cherem derabbeinu gershom offsets the chiyuv ksuba, so it really directs focus to this divorce prevention svar. Hi.
Have you ever heard people claim that the cherem derabbeinu gershom doesn't apply anymore?
They say that sometimes about more than one wife.
What?
The cherem of taking more than one wife. There are those. Right. I mean, it sounds like there's basis to say that maybe that was initially proposed temporarily. But I don't know if that extends to other.
I mean, apparently it has to do timing, like
in this case.
Date?
Yeah, there was some discussion like that.
So it doesn't matter which chayrim.
I mean, well, that chayrim, these two chayrim happen to be really two halves of the same coin, because you could exploit one without the other. That if a man wants to ignore his wife, so even if we don't let him divorce her, but he can marry somebody else, right? You know, this comes up nowadays with they have the get refusal issues. So part of the problem is that we don't want the husband to be disincentivized against giving a get, because they'll figure, okay, I can leave her and I can remarry anyway, so who cares what happens to her? So therefore, the fact that he's not allowed to remarry as long as he's married to the first wife becomes crucially important, because they're two halves of the same coin. If he wants to be free without her will, so either he could divorce her bar karcha, or he could take an extra wife. So we kind of need the two to come together in order to give her that full protection. Okay, so these are some important issues as far as figuring out the chiv suba, the raisa, the rabbanan, and how it factors in to the wedding itself. So now we have basically one last stage to our introduction. Hopefully we'll get to minchah also. So we'll, maybe we'll finish it now. If not, we're almost finished. But so how exactly do we relate to this payment? The payment to the ksuba, to the wife, what exactly does it represent? And this is really a theme for this week's parsha, right? That we find in this week's parsha the concept of motzi shemra, and we know that we have the chiyuv of the mafuta, that if the husband, if the boy seduces the girl, so then he has to either pay a knas or marry her. And if he marries her, then he doesn't have to pay the knas, but if he divorces her, so then it all kind of gets rolled into the ksuba. So the question could be raised, what exactly does this money represent? And what exactly does this 200 zuz, what's it there for? What are the possibilities? What do you see the money representing?
In the ketubah?
Yeah, the fact that he's paying her anything. The fact that he's taking on a chiyuv to pay or anything at the time of the marriage. What's that money for? Well, what does it do? You could say that essentially this is a part of her financial rights, and that essentially because there are obligations of each spouse to the other, that essentially this is kind of her payment, so to speak, her salary. Again, just to emphasize, like we said, first day we talked about Kiddushin, don't mean the payment for herself, not the Kesef Kiddushin, and not, we spent some time that day saying that's not what Kesef Kiddushin is in the first place. But this is different. It means that she's providing certain services. She's going to turn over her work profits, for example. So maybe he has a monetary obligation towards her, and that's what the Ksuba represents. It sounds like that a little bit from the Rambam and Mor Avuchim, by the way. Rambam Arivuchim seems to understand that that's essentially a sum that he pays to her. He uses the expression, schar socher, just like you pay your worker. So too, you have an obligation of money to your wife. You have to support her. You have to provide her with her financial needs. So the ksuba represents that money if you're not actually providing it in the context of the marriage itself. There's another possibility as well. Now, you could say that the ksuba, especially focus on the ksuba for a psula, so that represents the fact that a psula is more marriageable, has an easier time getting married. And if a woman's been married before, so then we have to try to offset that disadvantage, and therefore the ksuba of a psula is meant to correspond to that. Right, so we find some indications of that in the Torah. Right, we find the idea of the Mor HaPsulos, the idea that there is a knas for Ones U'Mafata. Right, one could understand in that context that, okay, now this woman's going to have a harder time. She doesn't have the status of Psula, So therefore, the money for the knas, or the money for the ksuba, is meant to offset that. Sammy?
Like that's far when you say that you only need knas for the ksuba, not for the ksuba at all.
Oh, so then the question is, what's the other way around?
That, according to this, you just said, that,
right.
then why would you need any monetary payment for a ksuba at all? Meaning,
for a ksuba or for a non-ksuba?
For
a ksuba,
because if a non-ksuba, the whole point is that for a non-ksuba, you want to compensate the man because she's less desirable.
No, we want to compensate her.
I want to compensate.
Yeah, I should be clear about that. The point is that we're worried that now she's coming out of this marriage, right? So she's going to have a harder time getting married than she would have if she'd never been married. So therefore, one of the things the husband takes on is that, okay, now I'm sending you out of my house, I'm divorcing you, so I want you to at least have something to offset the fact that it's harder for you to get married again. So the ksuba money may represent that. So to that extent, it represents the same money the Torah also would give this girl or her family if she was raped or seduced, because again, the same consequence, that now it's going to be harder for her, so therefore, essentially, when the Torah talks about kimor ha-psuos, so the Torah is going to say, all right, so now she has this issue, and again, we saw first day, the Rambam points out in Mar Nevuchim, it's not the only issue, but this is one of the issues that she's going to have a harder time getting married, so this knas is to offset that. So maybe the ksuba contains that within it, that now since she has to try to get married again, and now she's at a disadvantage, so the ksuba is supposed to correspond to that. If you saw yesterday the Shita Mekubetzes that we added onto the Maamar Kamos, right, the Shita Mekubetzes seems to have such an approach, that essentially this is a compensation for the loss of her psula status. Adam, any other question?
I was going to ask what the story was with, what if an almana or a grusha falls victim to like a super fata? It doesn't work in terms of compensation for that.
So the knas part you don't have. You have a tremendous aveira, and you know Bezdin can assess a proper penalty for that. But the knas that's mentioned in the Torah in these contexts seems to be geared towards the. That's what it seems like. So this is also a theme elsewhere in this week's parsha. It's also on yesterday's additional Maamar Kamos. Right, so you saw the Ramban in this week's parsha, and so we read also about Motzi Shemra. So what happens with Motzi Shemra? So Motzi Shemra in modern usage, we'll talk about this tomorrow in Parsha Shir also, and normally we talk about Motzi Shemra as slander. So in the Torah's usage, in this case, it means a very specific kind of slander. It doesn't just mean the slander that you say your friend robbed your lunch, but it means a certain very specific type of slander, that if a man marries a woman who claims to be a psula, and he then maintains that she's not a psula, and he's claiming this falsely, so then he has to pay 100. And so he has to pay a knas for that. So the Ramban explains that what's the whole idea? That the 50 that the Torah talks about as the knas for Anas and Mabatim, so that 50 is really there for her psula status. So here, he's trying to claim that she's not a psula. So why is he doing that? He's falsely claiming that. Why is he doing that? He's doing that apparently to get out of this payment. So it's Kielu, he stole that money. So we know that when you have a ganav who's caught with stolen money and he has to return the money, but he also has to pay the kefil. He has to pay twice that money. So the Ramban essentially implies that this guy basically stole this money. Now he has to give it back. And he has to give it back the kefil. He has to pay twice as much because he's essentially a ganav on this money that represents her psula. So the Ramban also comments there, if you saw it, that, so does this mean that ksuba is deraisa? Essentially, we're talking about the ksuba money. So here you have the din in the Torah that says that he's basically trying to cheat her out of her ksuba money, so he should have to pay twice as much if that's what happens. So the Ramban says, no, not necessarily. It doesn't mean specifically that the ksuba is deraisa. It means that it happens to be, the assumption here is the scenario was that he wrote her a ksuba, and that was the practice, as we were discussing before. Even Kod Neman Torah, that was the practice, apparently. And the Ramban says that if he didn't write her a ksuba, So then why is he doing this? Presumably he's doing this in order to get out of the chiyuv, doing this in order to get out of the monetary chiyuv. So that's the context. The assumption is that he took upon himself a monetary obligation, so he's trying to get out of it by making up the story. So it tells us a few things. Now it tells us, and it's about this pre-existing practice of the paying for the value of the psula, and that maybe the ksuba has that type of status. And as the Pnei Yeshua explains, that essentially that's really the story with the mefuta, right? That if a man seduces a woman, so we give him the option of either paying a knas or marrying her, but if he divorces her, so then he has to pay the ksuba. And the Pnei Yeshua writes that even if you say the ksuba is drabanan, that ksuba is deraisa, because that ksuba is essentially the same knas he should have been paying. He got out of it by marrying her. So if he now is going to unmarry her, if he's going to let her go, so then he goes back to the knas, so that ksuba becomes the original knas put in. Everyone following? We're moving a little quickly at this point.
The knas is the ketubah?
Yeah, basically, that the ksuba, or the other way around, the ksuba is the knas. Right? The mfata is chayav knas, right? But he could also instead marry her. So he got out of the knas by marrying her. But if he unmarries her, so then he reverts to the knas, which he takes the form of paying ksuba money. So the Pnei Yeshua writes that even if we say ksuba in general is drabanan, but that ksuba is deraisa because that represents his knas that he's obligated to pay, which he pushed off by marrying her instead. So I'm just afraid that I don't want to get beyond that. So is everyone following so far? We said a lot in the past 2 minutes, and then we'll just quickly review what we said. We'll have to go to Mincha. And then we just have a few more minutes to say about this, and then I really do believe our next Gemara day will be starting the Mishnah in the second parak. And I'm pretty confident about this point, but we just have a few more words to add. But let's just quickly sum up what we spoke about today. So we spoke about the Isser of being without a ksuba. Question again of whether that Isser is Bia, Yichud, marriage, what is it? And we talked about various nafkaminas for that. Nafkamina of if a couple loses their ksuba in the middle of the wedding, in the middle of the marriage, rather, years into the marriage, so what are they prohibited to do? And how could you deal with it? What are various aces to address that? Writing a new ksuba, giving her a mashko, writing a check. Could you rely on other things, such as the fact that there was a hischaivus in front of Edim, the fact the Rama says that nowadays the Isser to Megarish Balkarach also helps, even though the minig is not to rely on that. And the other major question is, how does it affect what has to be done before, what is the ksuba has to be done before what, as far as the marriage ceremony itself? And that comes up all the time as far as dating ksubas. It's part of the question of what date does the ksuba have to reflect. That becomes a very important practical question. And the Rambam, who wants the ksuba to take place before the yichud, and is told otherwise to be las nus. So we talked about, is that comparable to what he says about a chuppah's nida, that the chuppah isn't kone at all? And we mentioned the Beis Shmuel, who said, no, it's not the same thing. The Rambam holds the chuppah's nida is not kone. This would be kone, but it would be very problematic, at least on a level, midrabanan. And then we started talking a little bit more about the question of what does the ksuba really represent? Is it some type of kind of financial obligation for the marriage itself, like the Rambam in Merdevuchim seems to understand, or is it a compensation for the loss of the psula and the impact that's going to have on her marriageability from here on in? It's the way the Shittum HaKubetzes and Subas seems to understand. And we mentioned this Ramban here in this week's Parsha, that the Knas of 100 for Motzi Shemra represents the fact that he's basically trying to steal her psula money, so he gets punished by having to give twice that. And that shows you something about the pre-existing nature of this chiyuv. Not necessarily, says the Ramban, that ksuba is deraisa, but that the assumption here is that he would have written such a ksuba and that it would have obligations along those lines. Okay, any questions about any of that? Any issues? Okay, so we really are almost finished with the introduction. We will segue smoothly next time. But tomorrow, again, is a review of Kiseitze. Kiseitze is jam-packed. As you know, it's the most mitzvos of any parsha, so every aliyah has got a lot to say, so God willing, we should see some fascinating things tomorrow. And I wish everyone a wonderful day, and we'll see you tomorrow. Also,